yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and to give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and its Honorable Court. Be seated, please.
May it please the court, my name is Dennis Hart. Today I represent Gwendolyn Tan before this court. I must admit, when I first came into the courtroom, I was a little nervous. I saw what I thought was a room full of banking lawyers. And I thought perhaps the banks were out for Mrs. Tan again. I was relieved to look at the docket and see that they were railroad lawyers.
And your client was railroaded.
Well, that's certainly her view. It's up to this court to determine whether that in fact happened. In our brief three issues, we're going to submit on the first, and in the few minutes we have, we'd like to just say a few things about the other two issues, that is the wire fraud conviction and the abuse of trust enhancement. It's important for both of these to understand a little bit, and perhaps I should fault myself in my brief for not making it very clear about what Ms. Tan did and the sequence of events. And basically, she worked for three small companies, not at the same time, but in this order. She worked for the DC Independent Living from May of 98 to July of 99. And then in February of 2001 to April of 2001, she worked for three construction companies. They're a little confusing in the record, so I'll try and explain them. Atlantic Demolition, Utility Construction, and Atlantic Construction, I believe. She worked for them for a short time, 3 months. And then in November of 2002 through May of 2003, she worked for Generations United. Now, in all three of those cases, the government presented checks which basically bear the same scheme in this sense. They were checks apparently signed by the authorized signator, but in fact that person came in and said, no, that's not my signature. They were checks made out to Gwendolyn Tan, and they were checks deposited into her various accounts. But that really is the only thing in common, and that's why I go through that before I go to the wire fraud conviction. Because the appellant agrees that there was an interstate wire communication in the use of her resume to the third employer, Generations United. But what we disagree with is the requirement of the wire fraud statute that the interstate wire be used in connection with a scheme to defraud. The government says that because there were two other prior instances of where she engaged in this check scheme, that is evidence that she applied to Generations United to do the same thing. The problem with that is she applied to a number of other jobs and got the jobs where she did not engage in this conduct. The trial court recognized that at sentencing. And the second problem is that there is no evidence that she intended to do anything at Generations United until she got there. Clearly, the post-transmission.
You don't think the fact that she'd done it before and did the same thing again is evidence that she intended to do it?
Well, that's certainly the government position, and we would disagree.
Well, on sufficiency, we have to look at the facts that way.
Well, I understand that, Your Honor, and I agree with that bare-bones description, and that's why I asked the court to go in and look at what was done in each employment situation. For instance, if we had, Generations United, they used a QuickBooks computer program where Ms. Tan apparently was able to circumvent the controls on that and alter the QuickBooks software program, so she got away with it for some time before it was discovered. If that QuickBooks program had a common element among the other two elements, I would say yes, she did have that common scheme, but all three employers are different. All three had different schemes for controlling their situation. The construction companies, for example, had no controls at all. They just wrote, apparently, the old-fashioned checks by hand. It's true that Ms. Tan may have had access to the physical checks in the credenza of the boss's office, for example, but that really doesn't indicate that she would apply to employers in the future in the hope that she would have access to the boss's credenza to do the checks again. So I think that just because she did had a few things in common, it doesn't make it a common scheme for the wire fraud conviction, because the wire fraud conviction requires that scheme to be made in advance of the wire transmission.
Did she send the resume to other employers?
There's no evidence of that in the record.
What, in the sequence of things, were the employers for whom she worked but did not forge checks or otherwise defraud them all precede these three?
They were intermingled. The observation upon which I rely is the district court's comment that she worked for a number of other places without any trouble.
But that couldn't have, could that not have been all before these three?
It could have been, yes.
We don't know?
I don't know.
Record PSR?
It should be. I'm just trying to imagine that page in the pre-sentence report, and I can't picture it. The only thing we have in the record is the sentencing court's observation, sentencing. While we agree that the resume itself is not true, although I think it would be hard put to find any resume that doesn't fudge a little, the government's position in this case makes it a federal crime to fax a fudged resume if in fact something later happens at the workplace. And I think that's a dangerous precedent for this court to set in this particular case. The second area which we'd ask the court to address is the abuse of trust enhancement. The trial court considered this a difficult call and made a record for it in the sentencing. We disagree with that for the following reasons. We think that the appellant had no professional or managerial discretion that this court has required in the past for imposition of that bump. We would ask the court to consider its SMAW decision. I think it's called SMAW 2, which was, I believe, the FTC time clerk who took her position as a timekeeper to get FTC employee information and apply for credit cards, I believe. This court found that the imposition of an abuse of trust in that case was incorrect, was not intended by the guidelines. And the second case we'd ask the court to consider is the West case. In West, I believe that was the courier case. I'm tempted to say the bicycle courier who took the checks and opened an account and deposited those checks.
Isn't this more like Beecraft, the office manager?
Well, in a sense it is, yes. But I think most courts would say that the job title is not a bright line indicator of inclusion. So you can't just call her an office manager and say, yeah, she's included in this.
Right.
Because if you examine the testimony of, for instance, the construction company or I believe it's Generations United, where clearly it's the fault of the people who didn't review her. She had some responsibility at Generations United, but the person who was supposed to review the checks when they came back said she didn't do that for a long time. I don't think the guidelines were intended to punish a person who takes advantage of poor supervision and call that an abuse of trust and double punish the person. If the court looks at each of the facts of her employments, each of the three different employments, I think it will see
one of them wasn't counted for this. Right?
I'm sorry?
One of the employments wasn't counted for this. Only the first and third were, right?
Yes, yes. And all it would take is really just one, I suppose.
Right.
But in one and three, she was called an office manager. But that's not definitive. I don't think any courts have found that to be definitive. What's important is an analysis of what she actually did and how she was able to commit the crime. And if it was an abuse of trust, then that's one thing. But if it was a lax supervision in which her supervisors didn't do their job, then that should not be an abuse of trust, which results in double punishment.
Shouldn't we apply a deferential standard of review to this issue, especially in the wake of Gaul?
Yes, deferential, yes, but the application of the guideline is a matter of law, the interpretation of the law.
So the mixed question you submit is still a question of law, even after Gaul?
Yes.
Okay.
There are no further questions. We'd submit. Thank you.
Good morning, Stratton Strand on behalf of the government. May it please the court, as to the wire fraud points, simply it's not the case that there was no evidence that Ms. Tan had the intent to defraud at the time she applied to Generations and under the sufficiency standard. Some of the pieces of evidence were the fact that she was applying to the same type of organization, a small nonprofit organization, where there wasn't a lot of opportunity for supervision, the fact that she was applying for the same type of position, a bookkeeping type position, and the very fact that she falsified her resume in order to obtain that position, falsifying in a way that would not allow Generations to realize that she committed fraud at the last two employers.
Were these three employers sequential without other employment?
It's not entirely clear from the record. The only thing I know of in the record that speaks to that is her resume itself, which we've included in our record material, but I'm not sure to what extent we can rely on the dates that she gives for the other employers. As to the 3B1.3, I'd like to address both the Small and the West cases.
Can you address the standard of review? What's the government's position after Gall on the standard of review for mixed questions?
The government's position is that, as Judge Rogers suggested in Olivares, this court's traditional due deference standard continues to apply after Gall to the application of the guidelines.
By due deference, do you mean clearly erroneous, abuse of discretion? What do you mean by due deference?
As in Gall, akin to abuse of discretion. And in this case, it doesn't matter.
As in Gall. Akin to abuse of discretion.
Of course, abuse of discretion includes an error of law. You know, you abuse your discretion if you make an erroneous legal determination. So that
we've held several times.
Yes, I would agree that.
Yeah.
Applying the guidelines to the facts seems to me a mixed type of process.
But if this court had clearly held that it's the position itself that must be the repository of the trust obligation, and we were dealing with a case where that type of position did not exist, then would you agree that that's an abuse of discretion to apply the enhancement?
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
And it ultimately doesn't matter what standard, whether our traditional, your traditional due deference.
Well, it might matter.
In this case. We don't believe it.
Right.
It matters whether you're looking at this de novo.
Well, it might matter in this case.
We don't believe it does for the reasons stated in our brief. We believe that the cases that we've cited all make it quite clear that Ms. Tan held a position of professional and managerial discretion. As to the Small case, readily distinguishable, the defendant in Small was a GS-7 time and attendance clerk. There's no evidence that she operated with little supervision. There's no evidence that she had autonomy. What she did to perpetrate her fraud was to obtain personal information about FTC employees by looking into their records, and then on her own obtained credit cards fraudulently using that information. Here, by contrast, appellant had virtual autonomy in managing the finances of both.
She didn't have authority to sign checks.
Virtual autonomy in managing the finances. She did not have the authority to sign the checks, but she did have authority to submit for payment. She had authority to manage the books, to keep the check ledgers. She and the executive director were the sole people who had access to the locked up checks and checks registers, and in each case, the
access alone is not enough, is it?
Access alone is not enough, but it is relevant because it demonstrates the degree of trust reposed in her by those two employers. The reason that she was able to perpetrate this fraud is because they trusted her. They did not supervise her closely because this was her bailiwick. She was trusted to, quote-unquote, manage the finances. She was trusted.
This business of trust has gotten, I think has gotten to the point in some of the cases in other circuits where what you just said would be dispositive. The employer trusted the employee. That doesn't make it a position of trust in the sense of the guidelines, because the guidelines require more than the employer's trust. They require some sort of professional or managerial discretion, right?
These two things are linked.
Let me just go with the guidelines. The examples at one end of the spectrum are a doctor and a lawyer, right?
And a bank executive.
And the bank executive. At the other are the bank teller and the hotel clerk. So two of them are learned professions. The other is an executive in a bank who, unlike the teller has to tally out every shift, right? Close of the shift, the teller's books have to tally up.
Right.
So there's absolutely no discretion there. There's a camera probably on the teller. In fact, fraud by tellers is, I think, something of a thing of the past.
Right.
Here you have somebody who can't sign checks, is not given authority to do things other than what essentially a bookkeeper does. The district court used the term bookkeeper several times, I believe. Now, why is a bookkeeper somebody who is like a bank executive or a doctor as opposed to a hotel clerk or a bank teller?
Because she has the discretion to manage not only write the checks initially, but to manage the finances. She's the first
she
one
decide,
who
decide. What does she decide? What does that mean? What does she decide?
She
opens the envelope from the bank or the credit card company, right? So she has she is the mail opener. She uses that opportunity to throw away duplicate checks that are forged, and statement and credit card statements. So she's the mail opener. She's the data input person on the computer for QuickBooks or whatever they're using, right? And she has access to checks. So she's got two essentially clerical roles and access to the checks, which you just said by itself is not enough. I'm not sure why adding two clerical tasks to access to the checks makes it enough.
We disagree with the characterization as clerical tasks. She was responsible for reconciling the ledgers. She was responsible for notifying the executive directors if there were any problems with the finances. And as to your initial question, the discretion and the lack of supervision are linked. One of the reasons that we know she had discretion was because her executive directors trusted her enough to not look behind everything she did.
An invariable element of this case, of these cases under this section, that somebody mistrusted an employee. That doesn't make them bring them within the enhancement. If the janitor who cleans up in chambers gets access to my checkbook, it's not and we trust him to be honest. It's not because he has a position of trust.
Okay. The difference is, as in Beecraft, there is little supervision provided to this type of professional or managerial employee.
No one supervises the janitor. Well, there's a crew supervisor, but no one's watching the janitor when he comes into chambers.
If I could address the analogy of the bank teller versus the bank executive, the reason the bank teller is not a professional or managerial employee is because that person does not guard the hen house, as it were. That person has to account for the money that comes into the drawer, the payments that are made out, and at the end of the day has to account back for the amount of money that goes back into the vault. The person who is keeping track of the ingoing and outgoing money in the drawers, the bank branch manager, for instance, that is the person whose job is akin to Ms. Tan's. Ms. Tan
isn't supervising anybody. She had nobody who reported to her ever in any of these.
She was in such small organizations that she had all these responsibilities herself.
Mm-hmm.
She was the one who was responsible for ensuring that the money going in and the money coming out, the money coming in and the money going out, all balanced up. She was the one who was deciding, who was making sure that money was not, money did not go awry. It just as in Beecraft, we had an office manager. The office manager there did not have.
She had the means available to her. She had the means available to her because she did the data input, and she's supposed to reconcile the books, right? Like a bookkeeper.
Which one is that?
Always going to be the case.
In Beecraft, we had an office manager who did not have the authority to issue purchase orders herself. She had to send those up to a supervisor who had to sign off on them. Okay. She did not have final discretion, but because her supervisor trusted her to perform those duties correctly, he did not look behind her submission of purchase orders. And when she pocketed the money from the purchase orders herself, he didn't know about it because, again,
knew about it pretty quickly in this case, right? I mean, it didn't take long. These frauds came to light within months.
In some cases, close to a year. And in each case, she managed to.
In which case is that?
I believe the Generations United was close to a year.
She worked there. How long she worked there?
That was four. That was 6 months.
Did she work there?
Yeah.
And the fraud, the checks in the indictment don't span the entire period of any employment.
In 1 year at the first place. Center for Independent Living.
That's correct. I apologize.
All the checks were in the last 3 months, weren't they?
She had long enough to embezzle over $20,000 at each place. And the fact that.
Well, that could be one check. I mean, that doesn't tell us anything. Long enough.
These were small checks being written.
We know how long it was. The checks in the indictment span a few months of her employment at each place.
The checks in the indictment were far from the, were not the only evidence submitted. All of the checks that she used to embezzle money were part of the record.
Was the enhancement based on related conduct?
It was based on her entire course of conduct at each.
For which she was convicted. Here's at DCCIL, she works from May 1 year to June the next, 13 months. All of the checks in the indictment are in May and June, the last 2 months of her employment. So it's not as if she had a position in which she could, because of her discretion, go undetected for any length of time.
Your Honor, if you add up the amounts of the checks that were actually charged, it doesn't get anywhere close to $20,000. So clearly, she was being, this enhancement was based on charged conduct. She embezzled.
Uncharged conduct, related conduct.
I'm sorry, related conduct. But all of those additional acts of embezzlement, there were many, many, many more in order to get up to the $20,000 at each place.
Does the record show that?
Yes, Your Honor. All of the bank.
Can you say approximately how many more? Most important when they started?
Your Honor, her complete bank records from each of the complete bank records from each of the banks was adduced as evidence, and there was an expert who testified, who went through and tracked all of the different payments to herself and how and where those payments went. So it clearly was occurring over the course of her entire employment at each of these three employers. And the fact that she was able to conceal it related directly to the degree of autonomy that she enjoyed. She had first line access to the canceled checks. That allowed her to destroy the canceled checks.
What did the district court say about the laxity of her supervision?
It wasn't lax supervision. There's a difference between lax supervision, as in a branch manager who simply doesn't perform his duty of making sure that the cashier's money comes back reconciled.
Well, to go back to my janitor, if he starts taking checks out of the bottom of the pad in my checkbook in the chambers, and I don't know it because I don't reconcile my statement for months and months at a time, does that mean it's an abuse?
But you
does
haven't
that change his liability as opposed to my catching it right away?
But you haven't given the janitor the responsibility to keep track of your checkbook.
No, his responsibility is to clean the room, but the checkbook is there. His access to the checkbook.
And this is much more than an access case. This is where she is given. Unlike that, doesn't matter. The purchasing agent in Beecraft didn't have authority to issue the purchase orders. you did not give your janitor the responsibility to manage your checkbook, and that's why he doesn't hold the position of trust.
That goes to abuse more than the position of trust, doesn't it?
But these things are related. The cases that we've cited, including Beecraft, focus on the fact that of autonomy, the amount of autonomy given as relevant to both aspects of the sentencing guideline. The fact that you have a lot of autonomy suggests that you have that professional or managerial discretion. That autonomy also is relevant to using the position of trust in order to perpetrate or conceal the fraud.
I guess what I'm trying to draw is if you had an organization chart that showed that, you know, she was to be supervised directly by first and second line supervisors, but in fact they didn't do their job, you know, is that enough under the guidelines?
It wasn't that they didn't do their job. It was the nature of her job that they trusted her to handle the finances. They weren't being lax in supervision. That was her bailiwick. They didn't have to look behind her because it was her bailiwick. That's why it was a position of trust.
You want to return to standard of review? Is it your position that this is de novo?
No, it's our position.
I understand your answer to Judge Rogers' question whether you were conceding it's de novo here.
We're not conceding it's de novo.
The question of whether it was a position, abusive position of trust, is that de novo?
That's an application of the guidelines to the facts, and under this court's traditional analysis, due deference is applied to that question. And Gall does nothing but support that continuing viability of that standard, traditional standard.
And due deference, just to clarify this again, you would define as, the government defines as? Due deference is not really a standard of review, as I'm sure you're aware. Usually it's defined as clearly erroneous or abuse of discretion, which can mean the same things, or de novo. Which of the three?
Which of the three? I'm not sure that this court's prior decisions have made that.
I know. Does the government have a position on this? I assume in the wake of Gall, this is coming up all over the place, not just in the wake of Gall, long before Gall and Booker. And does the government have a position, so far as you're aware, throughout the country on this issue of standard of review of mixed questions like abuse of position of trust?
I'm not aware of that, and I would ask the opportunity to submit a 28K letter so that we have a chance to talk about that in the office. I would point to Beecraft, which ended with the following: for the preceding reasons, we defer to and uphold the district court's determination that Beecraft occupied a position of trust within the contemplation of Section 3B1.3.
In Mellon, we said due deference lies, quote, between clear error and de novo review. You said that
this is my problem.
But in this application of the law to the facts, an error in the application of the law is inherently unworthy of deference.
A clear error in application of the law would be.
You just said something different than Chief Judge Ginsburg did. I'm sure you're aware of
that. Yes, I am.
But it doesn't, if it's an error of law, we've said time and again.
I agree with
that. It has to be reversed if it's an error of law.
It doesn't matter
what the standard is.
The question is whether mistaking or making a mistake in determining that someone abused their position of trust is an error of law. You have an answer to that?
The answer to that is that I don't believe that that's an error of law.
Thank you,
Mr. Chief. Thank you.
The government suggests, and I would urge this court to reject the following proposition, that because a person gets away with something, they were trusted, and thus are subject to the abuse of trust enhancement. I think the court, the sentencing court ought to look at the facts, this court ought to look at the facts that justify that enhancement, and not use the bootstrap of, she got away with it, so she must have been in a position of trust.
Our role is a lot different than it used to be in these kinds of cases, after Booker and Gall.
Yes.
The guidelines are advisory. The Supreme Court's emphasized the primary role of the sentencing court.
Although usually I'm here in the opposite position, that right. is defending lower enhancements, right. lower adjustments.
Right.
But I do agree it is different, and the landscape is still changing.
Not sure we're supposed to be doing de novo review anymore of these kinds of determinations.
Well, I don't care what the court...
If we ever were.
Don't care what the court calls it, as long as it concludes that Ms. Tan was not given the upward bump.
That's a good
correctly.
Answer.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hart. Mr. Hart, you were appointed by the court to represent Ms. Tan, and we very much appreciate your assistance.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Strand. Thank you. Case is submitted.